I'm Louise.
I'm Marion.
Welcome to Not Quite There Yet,
the podcast that makes you feel connected to other women who share your inner experiences.
In here, we will talk about work, we will talk about growth, and we will talk about not being quite there yet.
Not quite there yet. Not quite there yet.
Hello. Hi, everybody.
Welcome to the episode I'm Not 30 Yet. And for that occasion, I must say something. Happy birthday, Louise!
Thank you. Thank you. Very excited. It is my 30th. Oof. Oof, oof, oof. Big 3-0.
Louise is turning 30, and I'm 33, so we're definitely in the 30s. And we wanted to do a special episode about what it feels to be in your 30s when you need to manage career and thinking of motherhood and all of these subjects. And for that reason, we actually read this book that we absolutely love with Louise.
It's called The Panic Years by Nell Frizzell. It's a book that really changed the way I was thinking about my late 20s. I read it last summer, so my last summer of my 20s, and shared it with Marion because I knew that Marion was going through a transformative phase as well with trying to become a mother. And that book was about that as well. And whether you want to be a mom or you don't want to be a mom, it's a question that you do ask yourself quite a lot towards the end of 20s, beginning of 30s, because it is that time where you kind of need to kind of make a decision because you're getting to that age. And 30, it's a huge birthday for everybody, but I feel like for women especially. So I'm very excited about this podcast. I can't wait for people to listen to it.
Same. I'm so excited. So yeah, just please stay tuned. I know it's a longer episode, but it's so interesting.
So today we have on Nell Frizzell. She is a journalist. She wrote for The Guardian, for BBC, for Grazia L, The Telegraph, for so many more. You also wrote for Vogue, and you are the author of loads of books. One that Marion and myself absolutely loved, called The Panic Years. Your latest one is Holding the Baby. And as important as everything else, you're a mother. So we're very, very excited to have you on today. A little bit intimidated, to be honest. but we're very, very happy that you accepted to join us. So welcome, Nell. How are you?
I'm very well. And that intimidation is going to last about 30 seconds. Don't worry. I'm extremely underwhelming in real life.
Thank you so much for joining us. It is just really great to have you here. How is your day going so far?
My day is lovely so far. So I have, today is a holiday in England. So I have my partner at home and my two children downstairs. There's probably currently three doors between me and them, which is a lovely place. Yeah, it's good. I had another baby 2.5 months ago. So I'm in that sort of I think I'm still on a sort of postpartum adrenaline high, which is quite, I've always said if adrenaline was a man, I'd marry that man. Like, in a way, it's sort of incredible. It helps you do things that really probably in your normal waking life, you wouldn't even attempt to. But right now I feel like I can take on the world. In fact, I remember after I had my son, which was 7 years ago, there's a big gap between, I went out for a run very soon after, like 3 weeks or something after giving birth, and this huge boxer came out of the mist towards me, like a very big muscly guy, and it was dark and I was on my own, and I remember just thinking, thinking I gave birth for 50 hours, you can't touch me, like there's nothing you could do, come at me. I felt physically like a superhero, and I think I've probably carried a bit of that through now, that I just sort of, it's not that I feel invincible, but I am so amazed by what the human body can do that I'm sort of relishing that moment of triumph for as long as I can.
Love it. Ride the high.
And I would always have thought that I I would be feeling like shit after giving birth. So that's a good sign. Thank you for sharing that.
I think you will feel both. You'll feel absolutely incredible and like shit simultaneously. So
interesting. Amazing. So as like our little icebreaker, we ask the same question to all our guests. So that question is, what did you want to be when you grew up?
It's so funny. I've been thinking about this. I remember being about, let's say, 8 years old and being at this sort of group. It's called Woodcraft Folk, which was a sort of, it is a European thing, but I don't know if you're aware of it. It was sort of developed as a kind of scouting alternative for the kind of progressive hippies of the world. Anyway, so I was at one of their meetings and they said, "What? Let's go around and you say what you want to be when you grow up." And it got to me and I said, "I want to be a comedian." And everybody laughed. And I said, "See?" Everybody will laugh. And when I was very little, I really wanted to make people laugh. And then when I was probably about 13, someone told me that you could be a writer. And I thought that sounded like an amazing thing to be. And then when I was leaving university, I had a big sort of jolt. I think I'd always been like good at things until I left university and suddenly I was just another person who had to prove myself in the world. And it was a big shock. And I went to see a counsellor who said, "Well, what is it that really makes you happy?" And I said, "Feeding people and making them laugh," which is sort of like I wanted to be a wife. So the sort of, strangely, I think now at 40, I can say the things I wanted to be when I grew up, I have been, and it's almost like a reincarnation. You have a chance to do a lot of them, but they won't look how you thought they would when you were younger. So I have fed people and I have made them laugh and I have written and I have done comedy. So I've done all of those things. But I don't know if I have actually achieved the ambition of my younger Nell self.
I love that. Thank you so much for sharing. And like your book also really funny. So I think like you were being a comedian even in the way that you write.
True.
Aw, that's kind. I think I probably also at some point wanted to be a vet, but it's a huge relief to all the animals of the world that I wasn't, because I'm not good at science and I'm not particularly sympathetic and I can't drive. So I would have just been sort of basically, people would bring me poorly sparrows. I would have said, "Oh."
I feel like a lot of little girls wanted to be vets. I wanted to be a vet as well. Didn't work out. Thank God for the animals as well. So we invited you to the podcast today because we both read your book, The Panic Years, Doubts, Dates, and the Mother of All Decision, which I love the end of that that name. That was a really good found name. And it was really eye-opening for us. And what I think is really interesting, it was eye-opening for both of us, but for different reasons. So I read it last summer. I had just turned 29 and I had just moved out of Dublin, which was like my first adult city where I'd spent like a lot of adult time. And it was such a big move for me. And I remember just reading the first page of your book and starting to cry immediately because on your first page, you talk about like the big changes of those last years in the 20s and the start of your 30s when you might not be in a relationship, you might not know what you're doing with work, you're just a little bit all over. And for Marion, it was really different because maybe you want to talk about this, Marion. Yeah, sure.
So like for me, it was a bit different because at the time I was trying for a baby. So I wasn't trying for like that long, but I was already kind of struggling with getting this going. And so it was more like interesting in terms of like reading that during that time where I knew that I wanted to have a baby and I decided that I wanted to go for it. And I was completely lost at that time, like in terms of career, in terms of everything. Everything was just really not going well. So it was so interesting to just like learn a few things. Like maybe Louise, you can just tell me about that term that I think it just made me very more self-aware.
Yeah. So that term, it's the panic years, it's the flux. So can you maybe explain the flux to our audience who might not have read your book and not know what that means?
Sure. So I would say congratulations, both of you. You've ticked off a lot of the bingo card of the panic years between the two of you. I started to wrestle with this idea probably at 28. It was such a period of change. And I felt very frustrated towards sort of my early 30s. So when things, there was a sort of arc to that narrative. I got really confused and frustrated that there wasn't a common language for this change that I could see had happened to me and was happening all around me, particularly to the women in my life, but not exclusively to women, I have to say. And in exactly the same way, we talk about puberty and adolescence. So adolescence is this huge period of change, normally between sort of ages of 13 and 16. And during that, we have something called puberty, which is when you go through physiological, irreversible change. So you probably will start your period, your body will probably change, you'll sprout hair and maybe boobs and your voice may change and all those delightful things that colour your adolescence. And then later in life, we have a period called middle age, and we define that. And during that, for a lot of people with wombs, you will go through something called the menopause, which again is an irreversible physiological change. It means you're no longer fertile and your sleep patterns may change and your libido may change and your hair texture may change again and skin and temperature and all those things. And yet at this period, which for me happened between sort of 28 and maybe 32, during which there was a huge sociological period of change, just like middle age or adolescence. And I was going through a personal physiological change, as in I was reaching a point in my fertility where it felt like if I was going to have a baby, just like Marion saying, you wanted to start trying now. And if you were to get pregnant, that would be irreversible. And if you couldn't be, if you found that you were infertile, that was probably irreversible too for a lot of people. And yet it didn't have a name. And I thought, well, it doesn't have a name. It can't be culturally recognized. Your bosses, your mum, your best friends, your partner, they won't necessarily be able to talk to you about it because we don't have the vocabulary for it. And if we don't have the vocabulary to talk about it, then we won't be given the tools that might make it easier. And we won't have a shorthand and we won't even recognize it in ourselves because we won't have a name. So I decided to call this period of change, the panic years, but within that, that physiological kind of biting point, you know, the sort of question of if I'm going to do it, I have to do it now, or I might lose the opportunity to do it ever. I call that the flux. And it's also, the flux can be in nature, a flux is a period where a river or lake reaches its banks and it sort of explodes out of the containing that it's had. And in the body, a flux can be like an eruption, like throwing up, or it can also be just like a change in state in physics from one to the other. So from, I think from like solid to gas is a flux. So I wanted it to have this sort of electric sense of change because for me, that's what that period felt like. It really did feel febrile and electric and exciting and at the same time, hideous and daunting and lonely. And I thought, well, then it should absolutely have a name. And it was remarkable to me that it didn't have one already. And I think one of the reasons why the book has resonated with people to any extent that it has is because it's given them a language in what was otherwise a vacuum and a really tricky vacuum. You know, it's mad to be, I'm sure you've had this experience probably, to be going to a wedding or a 30th birthday party and to be bumping into people that you were really close with at, say, 22. And say you've got a bunch of four of you. One might be married with two kids. One might have decided to take ayahuasca and is now living in a caravan in the middle of nowhere. One of you is maybe trying to buy a house and so you've had to stop fertility treatment because you can't afford it anymore and you've maybe like, had to change from going freelance to getting a proper job with a pension and all that kind of stuff. And then another of you maybe has just discovered your sexuality is different to the one that you had been ascribed, you know, up until that point. Maybe you are bisexual, but you've only ever had sex with men and you want to explore that. Like this was that like explosion of types experiences was happening to me over and over again where I was like, we at 22, we were all basically doing the same stuff. And now we look like we belong to completely different tribes. And that's amazing and remarkable to me. And if you can weather that change together, then all the better. And if you can keep working and it can enhance your career, amazing. But we do need to recognize that this is a very challenging time. And so I think that's where, why I gave it the name The Flux.
I love it. It's a little bit of a crazy time, to be honest. And what I really like is that I feel like it's happening to everybody, but at different parts of their lives based on who they are. Like I'm talking a lot about this with my friends in Bordeaux. And a lot of them are men who are nearing 40 and don't have kids yet. And I feel like they have the flux now. They're starting to freak out a little bit about having children now. And like, they feel like this big, big change, and didn't feel like that at 30, because 30.
Why were they not? Could they not hear us for that previous decade? Like, they discover at 40 things like fertility or
exactly like
responsibility or consequences to their decisions. And I'm talking,
opening up like so many things. Like now, like when we talk about dating, for example, so some of those men are in committed relationships and they can't wait to have kids with their wife or girlfriend. But those who aren't, like the conversation comes around, like, who do you date then? Because if you're dating women who are closer to your age, then the fertility comes around again. So it's interesting, because for men it's maybe a little bit later. And then I have my sister's 5 years younger. She's turning 25 this year. And when I was reading this book, we were both on holiday together, just the two of us, so I spoke to her a lot about it. And she said it resonates so much with me, because she has endometriosis, so fertility is a little bit hard for her as well. And she was telling me, it's exactly how I'm feeling right now. Like, I need to do it now, because I don't know what my fertility will look like in a few years. So kind of exactly that, the panic years, the moment where you're just freaking out about every single decision, because you kind of feel like it will have this massive impact on your whole life.
Yes, and they are. It is a web. It's a great interlinked web. You can't unravel one of those knots without it having a knock-on effect to everything else. So if you want to, in your case, move city, that's going to affect your relationships, friendships, work, income, sex life, all of those things. And Marion, if you choose to get pregnant, that's going to impact your career, where you live, who you live with, how you're gonna, like all of those things. So you can never, I think that's why it's so disorienting and discombobulating, is because each of these, what we have thought of as quite discrete areas of decision-making, family, love, work, whatever, they are, you suddenly realize, like an ecosystem, they are all interlinked, and you cannot focus on one without it having an impact on the others.
Yeah, I totally get that. I think for me, it kind of started at 26. I was living in Paris. I was like in a small startup job, so kind of have really like a not so great salary as well. And I was just not very happy there. But one of the main thing, I think, it was that I was not meeting anyone new. So I was really struggling with that. And I think the flux starting to like impact me in a way that I had to take big decision to just move forward. So that's when I decided to move to Dublin, which actually I'm very happy I did that. But I think it just like starting to happen to me that in my head, I was already sort of like planning for my life, thinking, okay, I'm 26 now. At some point, I'm going to have like a limit date on fertility. If I want to have kids, I need to meet someone. I need to do this, this and that before I get there. And I don't have that much time left. So I already had like that feeling at the time. And it's just like one of the reasons why I decided to move. And I think like during that period, it feels like any choice that you make is a life decision. It's irreversible. Like you just kind of leave behind your potential future whenever you take a decision. You leave behind your old self. Even just like in general, career choices, and they are reversible, they are changeable, but it doesn't feel that way when you are in a panic years. You just like feel like, oh my God, like whatever decision I need to take, it needs to be the right one. It needs to happen, and it's happened fast.
I know.
What would be like one of the biggest or more scary decision or move that you made while being influenced by the flux?
Well, I think a lot of it started with breaking up with my then partner of 6 years. So I'd been with this man from 22 to 28. He was older than me. He was 5 years older than me. And I had probably quite blithely just believed that he was going to be the person I did all the big things with, all those big ticket items. We were going to live together. We were going to have a family. We would probably, and he, you know, he was a graphic designer. I was an aspiring writer. So our careers were actually positively impacting each other. Like we could help each other out with work. They were very interlinked, but it was also a sort of another form of codependency. He could help me make things. I could help him make things. And I didn't know that I wanted to break up with him, but my body did, because I started having all, I used to wake up feeling sick in the morning and I would be feeling sort of panicky. And I had that tingling feeling in my hands and feet, like before you jump off something very high. And I'd be thinking, where's this coming from? And I thought obviously I was pregnant, because I'd be waking up in the night, I couldn't sleep, feeling nauseous, feeling panicked. And when I thought I was pregnant, I went to do a pregnancy test. And as I was doing it, I realized I don't want to have a baby with this man. I'm not ready. This isn't the right setup. And I think once I'd made that realization, like a ball rolling down a set of steps, like it was inevitable that we were going to break up from that moment on. But it took me a while to kind of realize. And I should say, he is still one of my best friends, and I saw him last weekend and he DJed at my wedding and he knows my son really well, and so there is a positive end to that story. But I think that that breakup was enormous, and it changed everything. I had to move out of my flat and I had to change the way I worked because I couldn't work with him anymore, and I had to really confront the maths that you're talking about, which was at that point I was 28. And I knew that my mum had got the menopause at 40. So if I wanted to meet someone, I had to get over my, I remember thinking, I've got to get over my heartbreak. That'll probably take a year or two. Then I've got to meet someone. That'll be a year or two. Then they'll probably want to be with me for a year before we start trying to have a baby. So, oh my God, I'm running out of time. I'm running out of time. Again, flash forward for listeners, I'm now 40 and I've just had another baby. So I wasn't quite up against my deadline as I thought I was. But in my head, this was do or die. And so I think the biggest change was breaking up with him. But then I also got made redundant. So I had to move from being in a salaried position to being freelance, which I had resisted for years, purely because I never wanted to fill out a tax return. I was so terrified of being in charge of my own money, and the admin involved in being freelance was, for me, much more scary than the work. I knew I could work hard and I knew I enjoyed my job and I knew I had good connections and all of that. But the idea that I would have to organize invoicing and I would have to save enough money to pay for my tax return, I'd have to submit a tax return, I would have to do that correctly, otherwise I might get arrested. You know, I remember having this sort of sweaty middle of the night panic that someone would knock on the door and say, you filled in this form wrong and you owe us £25,000 and you're going to go to prison. Like, I really thought that might happen. So being freelance, turning freelance was frightening. And then I think because those, you're saying, what was the biggest, scariest decision? In my funny little brain, the easiest way to deal with that was to decide to just say yes to everything. Because this was the first time I'd been single since I was 22. The world had changed. So rather than having to decide on a case-by-case basis whether this was a person I wanted to go for a drink with, this was a party I wanted to go to, if this was a job that would, you know, be worthy of my time, whether this was an opportunity that I should follow up, I just said yes to all of them. And I had an insane year where I feel like, if I think back that year, it was characterized by like just running up mountains and getting trains across the country to sleep with someone maybe who was actually 8 years younger than me. And then I would try, and the next week I'd be going to like the House of Parliament to try and campaign against it. You know, it was crazy, but it wouldn't have happened if I hadn't had that first sort of ginormous change of going from what I thought was security into insecurity.
Of that.
It's really interesting because what we also wanted to talk about today is really that aspect with the career, with the fact that in those years, every single change feels very major and it feels really scary. And with motherhood and planning to get pregnant, you do have a lot of things to think about. So we selected a few passages of your book that we wanted to read and talk about a little bit. So there's one where you talk about your friend Rafi, and you hear Rafi say to the woman next to her that if she's going to take time off and to have a baby, she needs to be promoted now, because who wants to hire a 30-year-old assistant? That's a big one. I kind of feel like it's the 30, it's the assistant, it's the baby. It
has everything.
All of the factors all together. And we talked about that with Marion quite a lot in the past few weeks, about having children when you're close to 30 or at 30. Because, for example, in my friends group, everybody has kids already. Like, I'm not even 30 and everybody has kids. So the career aspect, it was not as big a deal because it was before 30. So I feel like when you're getting to 30 and you don't have kids yet, or you don't want kids, like, career decisions feel bigger then because you have that stress there. And Marion, you also had one passage that you wanted to read.
Yes. Well, I had two. So that one, I really like it because it's very clear and it's very much what I feel. If I want to have the kind of career enjoyed by male and child-free contemporaries, as well as the kind of independence I always imagined for myself, then I have to get to the top of the ladder now before ever considering a family. I've been considering that for a while, so it feels very, even just very personal reading this, because I feel like since that story that I was telling, like, leaving Paris, I have been putting so much work into, like, climbing the ladder. Any opportunities that I could take to climb, I took it. And it was more out of panic than really out of what I really wanted, I think. Obviously, I'm happy where I am now, but just more out of this is an opportunity, let's just get it, let's just do this before having kids. And then there is another question I really like because it's quite funny. It's about you in a discussion. So someone is asking you, "Do you have children?" she asked. "No," I answered. "Oh, I see," she said with a knowing smile. "You're a career girl." I remember wanting to scream in her face that this shouldn't be our only choice, that mothers should be allowed to be ambitious too, that career girls should be able to have babies. Instead, I not so accidentally dropped some ketchup on her shoes, which, I think you were right, I would have done the same.
I suppose your revenge. But yeah, I did feel. But I think and thank you so much. It's so nice when people have read your book that closely that they can quote bits to you. It's such a pleasure. But I think what all three of those extracts show is this, like, real sense of panic that is at once motivating and debilitating. You know, it can be an incredible catalyst, you know, to be told that you only have a certain amount of time, that these two things are in competition, you've got to fight your way up, you can't do one without sacrificing the other. It really makes you move hard. And I do think if you want something done, ask a 30-year-old woman. They're, like, incredibly capable people. But it's also, if I was to step back, which I now can, because I'm just so much older, I can say, where was that pressure coming from? You know, was that something deserved and internal, or was it something external and learned? You know, had I just been told by a system designed by and for men that what I was trying to do, i.e. have a fulfilling career and a fulfilling home life, was an impossibility? Like, why have we been told that? Or that sort of, I think, third wave feminist argument that you can have it all, that you should do both, but you're not going to be helped at all in doing that. So you can do it, but it's entirely on you. And the systems and the structures that you live in don't have to adapt at all, which is also not fair or true. You know, I think it's one thing to say, yes, Marion, you've got to climb to the top of this ladder before you lose the opportunity. Or we could say, what, let's have a discussion about compulsory parental leave, compulsory paid parental leave that has to be shared by both partners, whether they're heterosexual, homosexual or other. Or let's have a conversation about workplace culture. Do I actually have to travel into an office? Can I work flexible hours? Does this have to be an 8-hour day, or could it be a 6-hour day like most childcare and schools are? Like, all of these conversations that mean that, like, brutal clash between work life and family life doesn't have to be so brutal if we are subsidizing childcare, if we're adapting workplace culture, if we are informing men about their fertility, if we have access to reproductive health care that is fair and valid and has fewer side effects. All of that means that you wouldn't necessarily be in that state of panic. And I can also say that at 39, I'd written 4 books and I was not sure what I was going to do next. And I proposed a fifth book about women-only spaces, and it got turned down by everyone, which is a whole other thing, which I'm very happy to talk about, but it's very hard. I had this, and I was trying to get pregnant at the same time. So this was it happened again. Almost 10 years later, I was in that situation again. And the book proposal got turned down and I had a miscarriage. And I was like, oh, we're here again. Like, we're in this state of like, what's going to win out? Do I have to put all of my attention in work? Do I have to put my attention on my body and biology? Am I going to get neither of these things? Then what do I do instead? And so then I decided to have a change of career and I started retraining as an English teacher. And then I got pregnant. So I can say, and I'm obviously in a hugely privileged position, but that actually you can get pregnant at other times and you can have a change of career later on. These things are not permanent. They're not fatal. You know, if you're not doing the job you want to be doing at 30 or 35 or 38, actually, that's okay. We're probably all going to be alive a long time. And even if we're not alive a long time, we're going to be working for a long time. So it's not to say that you're going to be trapped in a job that you hate or trapped in a career that isn't right for you. You can change. And I've recently had a really inspiring conversation with a woman who has had 4 children. And she started out as a nurse, then she retrained as an art therapist, and then she became a full-time artist, and now she's retraining at 60 as a physio. And I thought, okay. Wow. Like, so, and she, in all of that, she was a very attentive, hands-on, loving mother to all 4 of her children. But she was able to do that because she had certain freedoms and privileges that aren't afforded to everyone. So let's not be dishonest and say, don't panic, it'll all be okay. You've got loads more time. You've got loads more eggs. Your partner probably has sperm or you can buy some sperm. It's really challenging for a lot of people. But I think the narrative that, you know, at 35, your fertility falls off a cliff and that if you aren't above an assistant level at 30, you're never going to be employed again is probably reductive and unfair. And all it really seeks to do is put women in a state of panic and therefore deprive them of some potential power that they might otherwise have. So I would now sort of push against that from a position of someone who's 40 and looking at a change of career and all of that.
I like that today we have a lot of those stories of just people doing it differently as well and it being completely okay. Because I feel like I reread a part of your book today where it's talking about freezing your eggs and IVF. And I remember when I read that part last summer, I was horrified to find out that it's not as easy as it's being portrayed, that it's not like that miracle solution of you don't know what you're going to do, freeze your eggs, it'll be fine. And I was talking about this with my brother and we had a big conversation about freezing your eggs. And I told him I didn't know that it was so hard to do IVF afterwards. It's kind of presented as that solution that is just taking all of the boxes and helping you gain a few years in those panic maths that we're doing. And he was telling me, well, you should know this. If you're interested in your fertility, you should know it. And I was telling him that it's very hard as women, because that you can have it all, that we've heard so much. It's putting us in that mindset that career is good, having kids is good, fertility is going to be all right. And as you said, we are super privileged. I'm a very privileged person, that I don't have to think about a lot of hard things that other people might think about. And it felt super unfair from my brother to have that idea of, you should know this if you're interested in having kids. You should have that knowledge. And I told him, but it's not knowledge. It's just that that's the way that it's being presented to us. Yeah. And by everybody else, when I'm speaking to my friends about, do I want kids? Do I not want kids? I'm not really sure. I haven't met anybody that's made me want to have kids yet. And the response is always, get your eggs frozen. At least you'll have choice there. So it's interesting that you were saying that that fertility part is also like important, and that you can have kids at 40, but it's not available to everybody as well.
Of course it's not. Of course it's not. And so yes, the egg freezing thing, if you are interested in what opportunities egg freezing might give you, I don't want to say don't do it. And I don't want to say it doesn't work. I would say do look at the data. I can't remember it off the top of my head, but rates of success are much, much lower than you might expect.
Okay.
And also, let's be honest, we're living in a capitalist system, and egg freezing is a solution capitalism gives you to a problem capitalism has given you. We are told because we're living in a capitalist society, you have to concentrate on your career up until this point, at which your fertility might be less than it was in your 20s. But don't worry, we don't have to change capitalism. Instead, you just have to spend £10,000 doing egg freezing or embryo freezing or IVF. So capitalism has solved capitalism's problems. Bollocks. Capitalism is the problem. And actually, what instead of making women spend thousands of pounds on a thing that is of varying rates of success, we should be saying, what are the obstacles to people who want to have children having them at 20, 25, 28, whenever you want to do it? Because of course there are massive obstacles. There's interestingly an example here in Britain. We have an MP called Jess Phillips, a politician, who had her children, I think, at 20 and 21. And so by the time she got to 35, she suddenly had the liberation of someone with teenage children. She could go into politics. She could travel the country. She could really focus on work because she was no longer in a nappies, weaning, breastfeeding stage, sleepless nights, all of that I'm in. And so she sort of says, why are we telling young women that it's irresponsible to have children then and that you should be concentrating on your career? Actually, there's a whole flipped model of this where you have your children early and then you can concentrate on your career when they're in school or when they are independent enough to be able to have friends, stay at other people's houses, you know, enjoy the world outside of the home, all of that. So, or yeah, you work up until you are in your 30s and then you maybe have a baby and your job is protected, your industry still respects you, your intellectual capabilities are not questioned just because you've had a baby, all of the, you know, there can be huge alternatives to this narrative. And I think the egg freezing, I think it's a little bit scary how, because I don't know what it's like in Ireland or in France or elsewhere where people are listening to this, but in the UK, that's a largely privatized system. You know, to get IVF on the National Health Service is quite tricky. You have to be, here comes a big klaxon of discrimination, married and heterosexual in a lot of places to get IVF.
Wow.
Yeah, so same-sex couples can't access IVF, or if they do, it's only if their local authority deems funding worthwhile to go to same-sex couples, which a lot of them don't, which is inherently homophobic.
Yeah.
Single people can't do IVF on National Health Service. So even if you are a GP with your own home and £10,000 savings, you can't do IVF because we as the state don't deem you worthy of it, which is hideous. And if you are in a relationship, a heterosexual relationship, you still have to try for a certain amount of time, and it's still, you still only get offered a certain number of rounds of IVF before we stop supporting that. So there's so much discrimination in there. And then you're flung out into this wild west, like I say, of businesses that are making money off your body and your most primal desires in some cases, which is to have a baby and have a baby that you're biologically linked to. So then you are sort of saying to people, oh, have you tried, as well as getting your eggs frozen, you can try this treatment that costs this much more and it may make you more successful. The science behind that is extremely questionable. But who wants to be the person who says 10 years down the line, oh, well, I didn't have children because I didn't spend the extra £4,000 doing this other thing that was offered to me? It's a hideous situation that we're in. So, and to go back to it, Louise, it's not even particularly successful. So exactly. why are we doing this?
Yeah, that's so true. Like, I feel like, I don't know, since I'm pregnant, I feel like I'm angry all the time at the system.
Once you have a baby, like, you're going to be furious.
I don't know. Like, I realized before being feminist and all that there were inequalities around there. But now that I'm pregnant, I'm like, how am I supposed to be, you know, working the same as everyone, feeling like absolute shit, having like probably 70% energy less than I used to. And I'm still compared to my peers for the same amount of work that I'm supposed to be doing. I'm like, this is so unfair. And same, yeah, I see women who just got babies and same, like, they're supposed to be doing the same as well. And yeah, like, it just really makes me so angry to see that, like, we are living in a work, like a workspace that has been created by men, and we just have to adapt to it. And nothing has been done for accepting that we are going to have to go through work differently than men. And yeah, I just feel everything is so unfair right now.
It is unfair. And I do think, Marianne, that you're absolutely right. Like, it is insane that at this period when your body mm-hmm. is producing 50% more blood than my body has right now. That, I mean, imagine what that toll is on your organs and everything. And you're expected to work as normal. But what that is really important for is for me, as like a white middle class non-disabled person, I suddenly realized how intrinsically unfair our system is. Because imagine if you are a person of color, someone with a disability, someone with a lifelong health condition, someone who's just born in a low socioeconomic band, you know, your parents aren't educated or maybe don't speak the language that you're living in, or they haven't got qualifications. How on earth are you meant to not just keep up, but flourish, succeed, thrive? It's impossible. And so, huge surprise, we see people in positions of power tend to come from a certain group, and they tend to be, we know all the things. They are non-minoritized groups. They are probably men, probably middle class, probably don't have a disability, probably don't have a health condition, probably were privately educated, probably had a stable home, probably, you know, probably have lived in private housing that they've been able to pay for. All of that means that they can succeed where others don't. And it's not to do with ability. It's not to do with intellect or motivation or responsibility. It's because the system's rigged. And for people like me, being pregnant and having a small baby meant that I just momentarily and temporarily slipped out of the privileged bit in the rigged system and suddenly saw it for what it was. And that's powerful. And we should probably use that to organize collectively to say, if it's unfair for me and it's unfair for these people, then the system has to change.
Absolutely. Okay, maybe we can do this.
Get into positions of power and change things. So in your book, I think one thing that I really liked is it felt really researched as well, that you are talking about a lot of research and talking to a lot of very interesting people, whereas, like, whether that's some of your friends or other people who are really interesting. And a big part of that is how the flux influenced the career and like how thinking about having kids is going to influence your career. So can you tell us a little bit more about that, about the women and the people that you've interviewed for your book, about how it affected their career?
Well, if I think about, there was one moment that I think about a lot, which is I had been sent by Vice, I think, to interview this amazing international lawyer, humanitarian lawyer, who had, she was the woman who had got rape defined as a weapon of war, which is an incredible
Helen
thing.
Helen Durham.
Yeah. And so I was going to talk to her about that. And I was at the International Congress of Red Cross office in, or maybe it's just the Red Cross office in London. And we'd had this really interesting discussion. And like she had, this is a woman who had sat, you know, under trees with warlords, and she had gone to sit in tanks with like military personnel, and she had had to try and enforce the law, international laws of conflict, which we do have, which are now currently in our current moment completely ignored by like large swathes of the world. But anyway, and she'd done this amazing thing. She'd changed international law. She had recognized that sexualized violence is used in a military setting, and it should be defined as a weapon of war, just as other things are. But it got to the end of the interview, we'd have this very heavy discussion. And you will know, both of you, that when you're in this state, in the panic years, like running underneath all of your thinking, all of your socializing, all of your work is this like rat-a-tat train track of the same old question, which is, should I have a baby? 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 And in a moment of sort of deep, unprofessional madness, I said to her, I just want to ask you, do you think I should have a baby? And this woman, like, I mean, that due all credit due to her, she didn't flinch. And she just, it was like a beautiful moment of meeting someone as a individual and as a person, as well as in a professional capacity, because she just went, oh, right, okay. So, should you have a baby? Right. And she, I knew that she had six kids. I knew that she had this very illustrious, quite dangerous, interesting, compelling career. So she was a great person to ask. And she just said to me, which is probably the answer that I wanted to hear at the time, so it really resonated with me, but it might not necessarily resonate with your listeners. I said, should I have a baby? And she said, if you want to invest in the future and you care about the future, then why wouldn't you have a baby? And I remember thinking, yes, that's true. Like, there is no more direct stake in the future than having a baby. Of course, if you choose not to have a child, there are like incredible acts of investment and care and radical change that you can have in the future. I'm not saying you have to become a biological parent to do that, but because that was something I wanted to do, she was basically saying to me, listen to what you want, like in its most pure terms, what do you want? And maybe that's a good guide for what you should do. Dummy, but she did it very nicely. And so I think I probably, and at that point, I can't even remember now if I was with my partner. Yeah, I must have been. And I think I sort of had this idea in my head, because he was very reluctant to have children for all sorts of different reasons. He was very ambivalent about the idea. I felt like I could always walk in to the court of my own uterus and be like, for the defense, this woman thinks I should. Baby, what do you say? So yeah, it was really interesting talking to her. But I think it's also really important you talk to people who choose not to have children. So another voice in the book is this lovely woman called Jane, who was a lifeguard. I worked in this outdoor pool, which is a women-only space, and she is a carpenter, and she's incredible. She's so strong. And she's kind, and she's funny, and she's interesting, and she's dedicated to her community. She knows so many people, and she has this lovely open house, and people come, and she makes art, and she's just a real force of nature. And I knew that she didn't have children, but I'd never really asked her why. And so I sat down with her one afternoon, and I said to her, you know, did you ever want to have children? What did, could you, didn't you want to, what happened? And she told me that she was a queer woman. And because of it, she was 60 at the time. She had just grown up thinking that if you were a lesbian, you couldn't have children. And so it wasn't really a question for her. She just sort of assumed she never would. And her partner used to sort of laugh it off. If they were in parties and people would say, you know, if you have children, she'd say, oh, well, we keep trying. Like, you know, a lovely way to kind of dissipate that awkwardness around it. But she said, and I really believe her, she said that she loved to see pregnant women coming to swim, and she loved being around children, but she didn't, and she had for a few years maybe carried this sort of urge to have children, and she didn't, and she felt no grief about that. And she had dedicated, like, she had been a carer for her partner when her partner had breast cancer. She had done the act of duty and love and care that is so much of what motherhood is. She had sort of physically sacrificed for this woman, and she had been in a position where she could ease her out of life. Whereas I, you know, as someone who's given birth, you are bringing someone into the world, she eased someone out of the world. And so she had had that amazingly profound experience, and she carried no disappointment or doubt about that decision. She had not had children. She was very happy and very fulfilled. And so I think between those two women and all the others that are in my book, there is proof that there is no one right answer to this question of should I have a baby, should I have a baby, should I have a baby. What I would like is for us all to have the means and resources and freedom and support where it could be a genuine question about what you want to do, not a very restricted conversation about what you can get away with, which is how it feels sometimes. And it definitely felt at 28.
Amazing. If you know that you experience the flux, you experience having two babies, if you had to give one advice to kind of fight or just go with it, with the flux to women who are experiencing it, where would that be?
Oh my gosh.
tough one.
One piece of advice I would give to people who are in the flux or heading into it.
Yeah.
Well, it's sort of cheating, but at the end of the book, I do say these things that I still hold by, which are that, one, you have worth. You have intrinsic, inalienable worth that is not defined by your fertility or your relationship status or how much you earn or what job you're doing. You don't have to do any of that, and you still have the same intrinsic worth as me or Louise or Marion or the King of England or the President of France or anyone. Like, you have the same intrinsic worth. No one can take that away from you. So don't feel like you have to achieve these so-called goals to prove your worth, because you have worth anyway. It's yours. It can't be taken away. Secondly, there is such a thing as healthy interdependence. So don't worry that in order to be a successful woman, you are doing this entirely on your own, and you aren't reliant on friends, family, bosses, employees, any of those people, because that is not a safe space. In nature, any organism that tries to live apart from its environment dies. We are the same. You cannot be a successful person without a network around you. So healthy interdependence is real, and it's something to work towards. And I suppose that having a baby can be a beautiful, brilliant thing, but it isn't the only thing that will be beautiful and brilliant in your life. So whether you want to and can't, or don't want to and never do, or didn't think you wanted to and maybe have, like accidentally got pregnant or whatever, it will be both beautiful and brilliant and awful and terrifying and all of that stuff. But so will your other lives that would have been different. So it shouldn't be the defining part of you, because there's so many other ways that you can be defined. That's how I end the book. I would also say now, as a 40-year-old who's had two kids and has had a very different experience both times, I think I would also say, And it's the lesson that you can't hear until you're there. But this is temporary. It's all temporary. You know, that state of flux was temporary. The bubble of early parenthood, which feels so overwhelming and final and permanent, is actually temporary. It moves and changes. The state of being child-free is also temporary, because your friends will be having children. Your sisters and brothers might have children. You might work in an environment where there are children around you all the time. So although you might not biologically be a parent, that is not to say that you won't have children in your life. So everything is temporary and everything is in a state of movement all the time, including you. And actually, that takes some of the pressure off. You know, this isn't an ultimate final decision, because there is no such thing. The decisions just keep coming and keep coming, I'm afraid. So don't hang yourself up on the hook of permanence, because there's no such thing.
That is so good to know that. It feels very relieving.
Good. Yeah, it's funny. When my book came out, a few reviews said things like, well, the panic years made me panic even more. And I want to be like, that wasn't my intention.
Thank you so much for coming on. It was absolutely lovely to have you, to all of our listeners, read the book. It's so good. I keep recommending it to all of my girlfriends, because I feel like it's such a book that can be experienced in different ways. And it's definitely one that I enjoyed rereading to prepare for this podcast. So thank you for writing
it.
It's
so kind and so thank you generous, for coming on. And they were lovely questions. So thank you very, very much for having me on. I've had a wonderful time.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to us. We will find you again next month. In the meantime, please hit the follow button.
And tell us what you thought about the episode in the comment section. Bye.
Bye. Not quite there.